This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 103.5.
Welcome to it. It's Thursday. You're tuned into Nova 103.5, and that means at 6 p.m. it's time for the Business Report. My name's Gary Strubel, and buckle up. The next hour or so, we'll be touching on all sorts of different stories in the spotlight. Colette Rickett talks about her journey in education. The Namibia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, known as the Welwitschia Fund, was launched today. We'll be telling you more about that. We'll be going to the African Mining Indaba and talking, getting some feedback from that particular event, and there was lots of anticipation for that. And then also the Communications Act is looking to be amended with a clause that deals with interception. Lots of speculation, and we hear from all sorts of different people in our business community about their thoughts on this particular amendment. So lots to look forward to in the next hour or so. Buckle up. For now, it's time for the Business Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews, I'm David Bishop. While load shedding has persisted in South Africa for 14 years, Eskom CEO André de Ruyter warned against accepting it as their new normal, saying though that to address load shedding, between 4,000 and 6,000 megawatts of new power generation capacity must be added to the grid. COO Jan Oberholzer, meanwhile, said that the utility expects to have to pay between 15 and 20 billion rand for diesel in the current financial year. South African telecommunications company MTN, which has set itself a goal of cutting its carbon emissions to zero by 2040, has linked the pay of senior executives with the firm's environmental, social and governance targets of reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions, enhancing diversity and inclusion, and extending rural broadband. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Wednesday downplayed the prospect of triggering a trade war with the EU by threatening to pull post-Brexit arrangements in Northern Ireland, despite European warnings that he risks breaching international law. To read more about this story, visit the news blog page on the Future Media website. And inflation may be soaring, supply chains remain snarled, and the coronavirus just won't go away. But Al Jazeera reports that United States casinos are humming right along, winning more than $5.3 billion from gamblers in March, the biggest single month total ever. I'm David Bishop. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
The lead story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. Time now for our lead story, and what a story it may well turn out to be, either now or in the future. A clause in the Communications Act that deals with interception continues to be widely criticized, with many reports suggesting that government are now moving a step closer to spying and storing Namibians' mobile communications. And of course, the key question is why. Some are slamming it, describing it as a violation of the right to privacy as protected by Article 13 of the Namibian Constitution. We reached out to a number of prominent Namibians to find out their views on it. And here is Diane Hubbard, an associate with the Legal Assistance Center. Diane, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much.
Is access to information about personal telecommunications deemed to be this interception of private conversations and communication, is it deemed to be constitutional, or would it amount to a fair and reasonable limitation to the constitutional rights?
You know, this is something that only our courts can decide. But the scheme that has been gazetted so far looks to me to be very, very broad. You know, constitutional rights are generally not absolute. You can interfere with a constitutional right for an acceptable reason, but that interference has to be proportional. And what I'm worried about is that these regulations that have been gazetted would require your telecommunications provider to keep certain data about every single user, about every telecommunications that you engage in, who the caller was, who you contacted, the date, the time, how long the communication lasted. That's information that could paint a very thorough picture. And if you keep that for every single person who's using those services, if you think about it, the idea is that you're going to use it for people suspected of criminal activity. But that will be a very small proportion of the people whose data is actually stored. So I wonder if this is maybe not going much, much broader than what would be justified by the purpose.
So this information is already being stored and already exists, and the companies already do this. Certainly, most modern telecommunications companies are able to give you detailed billing, which infers they have this in digital form. Why is there now, because the Act says they must do something they're already doing, why does this feel like an overreach?
Well, for one thing, the latest thing that's been published, which are license conditions that were just published a couple of weeks ago, would go beyond where you have a contract and actually require this kind of data to also be collected for people who make calls with a SIM card. So one thing that this would do, if you think about cell phone use, this would mean there's no more such a thing as anonymous communication. Now, this is a thing that's debated internationally, whether or not people have any right to communicate anonymously. But you can imagine that there's a possibility that it could discourage people to speak freely, especially about hot political issues, if they know that their identity can always be traced. So there's a difficult balance to be drawn between wanting to put in place tools to stop criminals from doing illegal things, but without interfering with or chilling free speech and robust debate. So I think that is the issue that we have to look at. The other thing that's very worrying is part of what's been proposed would be police or intelligence services having access to this data with a warrant. But if they believe that the situation is urgent, police could go straight to your telecommunications service provider and convince them that the situation is urgent. I personally am very uncomfortable with the law being interpreted by my telecommunications service provider. You know, I think that we need to have courts involved to provide the appropriate safeguard. Another issue that's come up in South Africa is the question of if this data has to be stored as the regulations propose for at least 5 years, what kind of safeguards are going to be placed on the service providers to make sure they keep that data secure? I'm sure marketers and all kinds of people would love to get hold of that data.
Okay, so a number of interesting points. Firstly, accessing the data. Secondly, who gets to see and under what conditions what you've been up to? And then thirdly, the key question is there such a thing as a right to privacy? And I think that's probably at the heart of the debate. And it's it does raise an interesting point. Do we have a right to not tell the government what we're doing? Just quick thoughts in response to that.
Well, one thing I can tell you is that last year in South Africa, the Constitutional Court struck down a law that had a number of similarities to what's being proposed here. Not to say that such a thing would never be possible, but the court held that the safeguards were insufficient, that the law had not followed the path of the most minimal interference with privacy in order to serve the purpose. And I think that's probably going to be the issue that we'll have to grapple with here. Just want to make it clear, I'm not at all objecting to the police being able to have the ability to hunt down criminals. There's a lot of serious crime happening in the world. And obviously, that's an important issue that needs to be combated. What I'm questioning is whether or not the balance has been drawn correctly, or are we interfering with privacy in a hugely broad way to serve what is a much narrower purpose? And is there a better way to do it? And one example I can give is that some other countries use the approach that instead of keeping everybody's data, if police have a suspicion that somebody's involved in criminal activity, then they can go to the service provider and say, okay, we are investigating this person. We would like you from this point on to preserve the data for this identified person, because then we want to have a look at it. That would be an example of a narrower way that you can only interfere with the privacy of people that are already suspected of wrongdoing. So those are some of the kinds of things that I think we could rather be looking at.
Diane, that's what we've got time for tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Diane Hubbard from the Legal Assistance Center talking about the clause in the Communications Act that deals with the ability to intercept and infect forces telecommunications companies to store data for a lengthy period of time. For further comment, we reached out to former Ombudsman Advocate John Walters.
From the very start, start after this piece of legislation was promulgated.
My office and civil society were involved when we have invited by the National Council
submissions on part 6 of the bill. Part 6 is the one which will allow the intelligence and the police to intercept communications without warrant issued by a judge, and the National Council accepted our submission, said that would be unconstitutional, cannot be allowed. And now suddenly it's turned to a new phase where our communications will be now intercepted. People already allege in the past that it is being done already. It is not a new phenomenon. Our communications already intercepted by the intelligence of Namibia, whether it's true or not, but the allegations are there. I am a strong proponent of the a person's privacy. A person has a right that any communication of his or her must be kept private. And intelligence or the police or else can only access that through the strength of a warrant issued by a judge. But unfortunately, we live in a country where the ruling party and the government, when they start with an intervention, it's very difficult to stop such a move. But I hope that if such a matter, the government is proceeding with a matter, that we will have the opportunity to look closely at it and see whether we can stop it with the intervention of our courts.
That's former Ombudsman Advocate John Walters. Next up, Zoe Titus, the director of the Namibia Media Trust, had her thoughts.
On April 28th, a raft of new regulations were gazetted that operationalized Part 6 of the Communications Act of 2009. Based on these new regulations, all mobile phone users are obliged to register their SIM cards, which would now allow for interception of their communications and, in our view, open the door for mass unchecked surveillance. Places an added burden on telecommunications companies, for example, who are required under these regulations to store data of their clients for up to 5 years. This is apparently intended to combat crime and safeguard national security. But elsewhere, you know, experience has shown that SIM registration has not been effective in curbing crime, but instead has fueled it. States that have adopted SIM card registration have seen the growth of identity-related crime and have in fact witnessed black markets pop up to service those who wish to remain anonymous. Our concern particularly is for the work of journalists. It threatens their ability to do much-needed investigative journalism. It threatens their safety and that of their sources. We feel that there is a need for more transparency into the workings and practices of state security, intelligence, and law enforcement agencies and their functions that relate to communications monitoring, interception, and surveillance. Because the absence of personal data and online privacy protection, as well as transparent oversight mechanisms, leaves much room for abuse.
They have a number of different views, thoughts, and concerns from Namibians from different parts of our economic sector. The Communications Act, changes to that will force telecommunications companies to store data, that has some potential upside, but also has the potential to remove privacy and eliminate some element of the right to privacy that should be enjoyed by Namibian citizens. That lead story was proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
It's the Business Report here on Nova 103.5, and time now for our spotlight feature. And in our spotlight feature, we identify prominent Namibians who are making differences in all sorts of different areas of industry and life, and hear a little bit more about how they arrived at this point in their lives. This evening, we talk to Colette Rickett, born Visa, who is the managing director of Windhoek Gymnasium and also of all the Curo businesses in Namibia. Colette, that's correct?
That's correct, yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So let's just start out. Born Namibian?
Born in Cape Town.
Okay.
So I grew up in Cape Town. I had a wonderful family, stable, secure, loving family there, but very poor. So we were not used to all the luxuries that the kids around us had, which of course inspired me a lot to really break that circle and to make something more in life. Then I studied BA accounting at Stellenbosch University, met my husband there in my first year, got married right after I completed my degree, So we married very early because I had to join him to come back to Namibia.
Okay.
He's a clinical psychologist and he had a bursary here at the Ministry of Health, but he had to work back. And we always thought it's just temporary and then we're returning to Cape Town. But today still, this is where we are and where we always want to stay.
Okay. And if I can just stop for a second there. So perhaps not coming from a particularly advantaged background, how did you get into varsity? What was that bridge that you were able to cross?
I studied so hard and I got very good marks and I got a bursary, scholarship and everything that I needed. So that really gave me that edge to get into the university.
I think important often for young people to hear that even though there are obstacles, there are ways to overcome them.
That's right.
And
I always tell them, everyone gets handed a plate in life. And whatever that is, good or bad, however you might see that, that is what you have to use to reach your optimal success in the end.
So tell us a little bit of how you got into this education space.
Okay, so after I did my articles at Coopers & Lybrand here in Windhoek, then I was an entrepreneur with various businesses. I was a lecturer at UNAM. I was involved with some private schools where I was their business manager and had some feeling of education and really experienced a lot the pressure that education is under. And at the time, there was also the sort of a plunge in school education in Namibia, which I identified, not really having kids at the time yet, but saw the need for good education in Namibia. So then in 2003, I just had this vision from the Lord that he said, someone has to do it. You have to make this impact in Namibia. And coming from my situation and the background and everything that I've experienced, I'm really a very positive person and someone who always looks for a solution where there's a problem. So, of course, I saw this problem in Namibia and I was inspired to be the one to make that difference. And then I started. It was not only about starting a school. It was really about the whole education sector, really making a difference there. And then I knew I had to start a school that could set a benchmark and for others to know this is what we can offer in terms of education for learners. And since I started, it was a 24/7 job. Today still is. In between, I had my children, who is today 25 and 21 years old. Twins who are 21, our boy and a girl, also studying BA accounting at Stellenbosch University. The oldest one did his BA a Greek degree and he's busy farming and securing food for the future in Namibia. So then I was into schools and the more I was into it, the more I saw the need and the lack of standard in other schools where kids came to us and we saw, well, why is this backlog here? And then I was sensitized about education in Namibia overall because it's no good only having 1,500 or where we are now, 2,500 learners. Not only a small group of children to be able to impact them, but really to impact the larger group of all Namibian kids because they all deserve a quality education.
So we'll get in. We'll talk a little bit about education in general once we've heard what track you've picked for us.
Mm-hmm.
But we speak to a lot of female leaders, women leaders, and they have different stories to tell sometimes. As someone who has been entrepreneurial from the onset, tell us a little bit about your path as a woman in business.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of barriers have you faced? Have you personally experienced challenges because you're a woman?
Yeah, I must say, especially initially, you really experience that because in Namibia at the time when I started and with all the negotiations with banks and other shareholders, there was always that type of, oh, it's another girl coming in and so on. But I soon learned how to turn that around and really use the heart of a woman and the sensitivity of a woman to impact men in the way that they think about life and about business. And I think that has given me some sort of edge to really be able to speak into a meeting sensibly, because I really care, and I don't care only about business and not care only about finances, but I care about the people involved.
So Gwen Lister was angry with me because I didn't ask her this particular question. So thank you for answering it.
Yeah.
Are things changing in that regard? Do you think those prejudices are still long held, or are you experiencing a change in the way?
In some businesses, you definitely still see it and experience it. But I must say, as far as my stakeholders and people that I deal with, there's no shortcoming in, or no something that hinders me in by being a woman. I think people have learned to respect the quality that a woman can bring into business.
And of course, one of those qualities is being a mother. You spoke about your children just now.
Yeah.
And having to juggle the traditional role of wife alongside the traditional role of mother and the incredible demands that a full-time calling vocation would give you. So just talk to us a little bit about how you managed to juggle all of those things and produce people that are going to make a difference in the world.
Yeah. Gary, I can tell you initially, I mean, I really didn't know what I was getting into when starting the school. I didn't know what a 24/7 job this really would be all the time. So when I had my kids, it was definitely always about planning, and about every day we literally, when they started going to school, then my husband, his clinical psychology practice, he worked only half day, and then he was the dad who took them around, and a lot of support from that side that I'm very thankful for, and the kids as well, because he's helped me to really make this impact. So a lot of support from hubby, and the kids were always part of the dream. They realized mommy's not only building a school or just attending a function, she's making a difference in education. So, and that is totally where their hearts lie as well, to really impact Namibia with the things that we do as a family. So that was always precious. And of course, being at school and experiencing the school, the hall gatherings and some very special moments with the kids, that was wonderful. And I loved, my kids are good in sport and culture, and I loved those precious moments next to the field, next to the sports field, seeing them on the stage and so on. So that was really precious. And I remember when my oldest son, when he matriculated on the last day, then he said, "Mom, you weren't always there physically, but you really gave us this great experience and the school that we would never have had." So he saw the role I indirectly played in his life and the value of his education as well. So one appreciates that.
Well, congratulations on getting that balance right.
Thank you.
We'll get into education in a second. But first, you're making an impact in education, but you also now get to make an impact on the playlist. Tell us what song you've selected and why.
For today, I've selected the song "You Say" of Lauren Daigle, which is always an inspiration for me to know, no matter how low I feel, and especially for the kids that I deal with a lot, where often they feel hopeless and they feel they don't have a meaning in life, then to listen to this and say, when I feel I'm not good enough, then the Lord says, "You are excellent. And how special you are." And if every person can understand that in life, and every child, then you can function optimally. You can study, you can do your sports, all of that you should do. You can do that optimally because you know your own value.
I keep fighting voices in my mind that say I'm not enough. Every single lie that tells me I will never measure up. Am I more than just the sum of every high and every low? Remind me once again just who I am, because I need to know. Taking all I have and now I'm laying it at your feet. You'll have every failure, God. You'll have every victory.
Lauren Daigle here on Nova 103.5. I'm talking to Colette Rickett, and we'll get into a little bit of education now. Colette is the Managing Director for Curo in Namibia and as well as the Managing Director for Windhoek Gymnasium. So, private school initial. Perhaps just take us through those first early phases. As my understanding is Curo only came in later
yeah.
and basically did a buyout.
That's right.
And then have given an opportunity for further expansion through obviously
a
massive balance sheet, huge resources and facilities. So there's two phases to this. The first one would have been startup.
Yes, the
How
first
hard
one
is it
was
to start up a private school.
It was a personal struggle, really. And I had to keep reminding myself why I'm doing this. Because initially there were a lot of admin things and things that you had to overcome. I mean, you have no history. You only have a dream and how to sell that to a bank. Today, it's even more difficult. But at that stage already, it was difficult to convince them to give a few million to start a school that you really dream of and that you see. And people thought, no, there's not really a place for such a school in Namibia. It's not necessary. Yeah. We're
solution
doing
for a problem
fine.
We don't have. Don't
yeah.
We?
So that was one thing. And I think now, I experienced so many times that people really understand they didn't know what was possible and now they see it. So that's a great thing for me now. I lost a lot of friends who were very, who had the schools that they support and they were loyal towards them and they didn't want this dream to realize. A lot of people from other schools also who were very negative. And I mean, me being a positive person and someone who really tries to be kind to all and please everyone, it was very difficult for me personally until I just came to my own belief that I know what I'm doing, what I'm working towards, so I have to let it go. I have to not try and keep everyone happy. So that was difficult. It was difficult getting the finances initially and then to convince the government of where we are going and to get that registration in place and so on. But, I mean, soon as we started, people realized more and more the value of the school. And then we came up to a stage when we were in 2015 where we needed to expand with things like an Astro hockey turf, with proper more facilities, because every year literally I could only try to build for the demand that there was. So we had huge waiting lists and building literally every year somewhere on the terrain to get more classes and so on. And then Chris van der Merwe, who was the founder of Curo Schools in South Africa, he phoned me and he said the school appeared on his radar and he wants to buy me. And it came 2 weeks later. We had half an hour discussion about my vision and what I see and how I want to expand in Namibia. And then the deal was done. So then they bought Windhoek Gymnasium and the profit of that went into a trust, which is now catering for teachers who want to study education. So that's a great way to have utilized those profits. So now we became a company, and I had to get used to always where I always did my own thing and just like I wanted to. Now I had to get used to all the corporate governance and so on. But then they also bought into my dream of expanding and giving this opportunity to more and more Namibians. So it was, we started in 2007, 2016, the 1st of March, Kiro took over the school, bringing the facility, the financing that I want. So I still wanted to build beautiful hostels, the AstroTurf, another huge classroom block, make the hall bigger and nicer. And so all of that they stood in for, so that I could just sooner reach the complete dream. So there's still a little bit of things that needs to be done until the buildings and everything is complete. But I think where we are now, and also with the success of Windhoek Gymnasium, it was so much easier to get the right stakeholders involved for the expansion of this type of school in Namibia. So we've started one in Stamperit, Roots Gymnasium, which is a smaller project, but also with this dream of making it a really wonderful and big agricultural school for Namibia, having a commercial farm on the same property where the kids can really do everyday modern, learn modern techniques of farming in order to secure food for Namibia. I heard the other day they said once all the rivers run dry, all the fish has been caught, all the trees have been
cut down,
then we'll realize that we can't eat money. And that's what we are planning towards, to prevent that problem for Namibia in the future.
So let's just talk about education in general. We've seen, like with private healthcare in the 90s, private education out of the 2000s, largely driven by this very large South African economy just below us. It feels like that need is expanding for these African economies to stay engaged with the world. It often feels like the gap between the more developed nations and the generic education, certainly primary and then obviously secondary, tertiary, the gap feels smaller. But at school, it feels like the gap keeps growing. How much of a challenge of it is it to keep narrowing that gap, understanding that you're part of a bigger ecosystem? As much as you can control your environment, you can't control the education environment, the industry within which you move. How do you balance those things between private enterprise and then the state upon which you're hugely reliant for the space you operate in?
Yeah. So I'm part of the advisory council for education to the Minister of Education. And we look at the problems that we face, and I have a lot of solutions. But then it's always not that practical regarding the large numbers that the government schools or the Ministry of Education has to cater for. And the sometimes the level of student in their minds that they have to cater for. So
numbers keep getting bigger, right?
That's right.
The population pyramid for Namibia, it's every year there's more kids that are kind of come through the system, and there doesn't seem to be more schools.
Yeah. And what is bothering to me is the fact that we don't start with basic education and get the foundation right there. I mean, a child cannot be promoted to grade two if he can't read in grade one. Now we have kids sitting with the automatic promotion system sitting in grade 10 already. They can't read and write. What are they going to do with their lives? So there's a lot of obstacles and a lot of things. But I mean, as I said, my heart for education is long ago has changed to the Namibian child and not just the children that we can cater for. So yes, we need to bring centers of excellence to more parts of the country. And that and including the government schools in the region in terms of sport and in terms of the intellectual property that you can share, so that they are able to sort of keep up with what we are doing. Because we don't want to see education, for me, is the only equalizer, and it's the only way that we are going to secure a good socioeconomic development in our country, and to make it possible for children who did not have many opportunities, like I did, and to really make that difference through education, so that the children can lift up their lives and provide better for themselves and for their family than their parents used to do. So
let me ask a structural question quickly. In Zimbabwe, we know that Robert Mugabe in the first 20 years of government invested heavily into the education system, which was largely British-based at the time. And as a result, Zimbabweans have enjoyed a much higher level of education than most of the southern African countries. South Africa seems to have, in many cases, been held aloft by the Model C system.
That's right.
Does Namibia look at the Model C environment and wonder if there's been an opportunity missed, or do they think they've dodged a bullet by allowing elite education to flow somewhere else? I mean,
I don't want to answer that question directly because of my involvement with the ministry. So, but I think definitely that is a very good solution. If we could combine where the government supplies the facilities that has already been built, that needs to be repaired and so on to some extent, and combine that with at least the private initiative from the parents involved in that school, that will be a very good initiative. And I mean, parents have realized that education, you can't offer free education to all. It's not a practical solution. It costs a lot of money. It prohibits schools where some parents do have the capability of paying for things to not be able to maintain their facilities and improve their facilities. So that, I think, is a very big obstacle.
So why aren't we pursuing this? Why isn't this a discussion?
It's a discussion.
It's a complex discussion.
It is a complex discussion. And I mean, to always convince people in the political seats of what we really need for education in Namibia. But I mean, that's something that we have to pray for. And I think that we do impact that to some extent and do already contribute a lot. But there's a lot of solutions that we can talk about, but you don't always find the right ears to discuss it with.
Okay. Just briefly, Colette, we're nearly out of time, but the guys at Curo then started looking at tertiary and got excited about that and have started investing quite significantly in that space as well through other holdings. Any ambitions in the Namibian context for tertiary education?
Yeah,
solutions?
For sure. So they started Stadio, and at the time they called it a multiversity, which is really not only about degrees. Mm. So it's a lot of focus on vocational training, things like film schools, hospitality schools, etc., that they bought out, but then also an education of a faculty of education and all the other fields, commerce fields, etc. So they are like a big umbrella.
Just seemingly
for
a more practical solution for today's problems.
Exactly. Right? And that is what we intend to do in Namibia. So we're already starting to plan the tertiary faculty for training of teachers, because that is the biggest thing that we need in Namibia in our education sector, because only 25% of teachers are trained to offer the subjects that they have to offer in our schools. And I mean, then what can we expect
exactly
from the learner's performance? And so we have to climb into the education of teachers significantly. And then, of course, one very big vision of our family, my husband in particular, is to raise the standards of agriculture and to really use our resources and just get so much more in terms of foreign currency into the country, supply more food for our country so that we don't always have to buy from outside and so on. So agricultural training is a tertiary institution that we are going to do with the University of Stellenbosch at the Roots campus. So we're excited about that, and to then you're able to get your BA degree from the University of Stellenbosch just on a on a foreign campus, a satellite campus.
Exciting times ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sure 24/7 is going to turn into 25/8 shortly with all of these projects. Khalid Rickett, thank you for joining us this evening on The Spotlight. And you, the mission that you're busy fulfilling in the Namibian space, I know I speak on behalf of many parents to say thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive. Or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything.
Time now for the BizNews Wrap. And as usual, we peek over the borders of our southern neighbors and have a chuckle at what's going on there. And today's story is no different. It is a crazy piece of, firstly, some pretty good journalism, but a crazy story. South Africa's largest Bitcoin scam, and where there's speculation and where there's greed, there's almost definite to be some form of fraud as well. And an article published by Ross Sinclair on BizNews, but by Jan Vermeulen, originally published on MyBroadband, has popped up with the title of Masterminds of South Africa's Biggest Bitcoin Scam Summoned on the Hook for 4.7 billion rand. Now, joining me from BizNews, Michael Apple, welcome to the show again. What a story. And I mean, this is the first of its kind, right? So really big news in terms of I'm trying to crack down on this sort of thing.
Yeah, 4.7 billion reasons to cry if you're one of those people who bought Bitcoin, invested it, gave it over to MTI. I don't know about you, Gary, but I think it was in the name, Mirror Trading International. I hear mirror, I hear smoke and mirrors, I hear dodginess, and that's exactly what this has turned out to be. So the article basically names the 18 individuals that have been referenced in court papers as being held personally and cumulatively liable for this as the sort of management team of MTI. It's being called the biggest cryptocurrency scam of 2020. And they are looking basically at how these guys were promising the guy on the street a way into trading on this Bitcoin platform. And they were publishing false trading reports, in essence, to kind of create the ruse that there was anything to MTI as a functioning Bitcoin platform. And then what they were doing was they were taking the Bitcoin that was invested and simply diverting it to their personal wallets. Everybody at MTI, and the article does reference it, speaking to at least one of the implicated, saying that this all will be revealed in court, that this wasn't a criminal enterprise, or that there was nothing reckless about the way that the company was run. But 4.7 billion rand lost to investors there. And Mr. Steinberg, Johan Steinberg, if there was nothing wrong about the way in which the company was run, why did he decide to forcefully emigrate to Brazil, which is where he was apprehended, and he is due to be sent back to South Africa to face the music, Gary?
So, I mean, these numbers are staggering. They were supposed to have over 22,000 Bitcoin in their accounts at the time of the implosion. That's around 11.6 billion at 500,000 per Bitcoin. Bitcoin has taken a hammering. It was trading as high as 800,000 Rand a Bitcoin, which would take that amount to nearly 20 billion Rand that of money they had taken in. And it continues to astound me as to how much money Ponzi schemes attract. And it just continually the the consumer and how willing they are to part with their money. These are enormous amounts.
So you have two court cases, in essence, as well, unfolding at the same time, simultaneously. You have the application by the liquidators to claw back the over 4 billion rand. And then you have an application to have MTI declared a Ponzi scheme. So the one is happening in the High Court in Pretoria and the other in the Western Cape High Court. So the application is being opposed by the investor groups who they think, some think it's going to make it a lot more difficult for them to get their payouts if this is declared a Ponzi scheme. But that Ponzi scheme application will go ahead in the Western Cape High Court. And it's interesting to see if any of these 18, and I mean, it's a mom and pop shop, it's Steinberg, it's his wife, it's a couple of mates. I mean, they've named them all here, head of strategy, head of corporate services, the COO, trainers and presenters, head of legal, all of these people are going to have to face the music. And let's see if somebody either faces jail time here or, I mean, most of these people, Johann Steinberg at least, has been sequestrated. But let's see if they can claw back some of that 4.7 billion.
Yeah, and it's also a lesson to two directors, senior executives in these fintech startups, all sometimes promising very unrealistic expectations, that everyone's accountable to the promises made to consumers. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. That's what we have time for this evening. We'll chat to you next week.
Cheers, Gary.
And that's it for this week's Biz News Wrap. An interesting story. Huge amounts of money. Now, as this thing gets declared a Ponzi scheme, we hope MTI wasn't in your portfolio. It doesn't mean Bitcoin's a Ponzi scheme, although the jury's possibly still out on that as well. What it does mean is that that particular investing house went about it entirely the wrong way. That's it for the Biz News Wrap.
The Biz News Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors.
Gary Struble on The Business Report.
Welcome back. It's The Business Report here on Nova 103.5, and time now for the Market Watch. And we thought this evening we'd take a look at the big market. Namibia's trade with the rest of the world increased by 22%. That's year on year, to reach 15 billion Namibia dollars. That was March's numbers, compared to 12.3 billion recorded March last year. Like most markets, there's been a bit of a rebound and an increase in demand. These are the latest figures. These are March's figures. The Namibia Statistics Agency says the 15 billion dollar trade figure was, however, 12.5% lower than the 17.1 billion registered in February of 2022. So February, a bigger month in terms of that. We decided to learn a little bit more about this big market, and we asked Theo Klein, an economist from Simona Storm Securities, to join us in the studio tonight. Theo, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So these are big macroeconomic discussions, and for the man in the street, often these are, it almost feels like someone else takes care of these things. But when we start breaking it down, there's not much different from the macroeconomic space and someone's own bank account. Money comes in, money leaves, gets spent on things. Tell us a little bit about this export growth. This is a big deal for Namibia. We're currently a net importer. What is the monthly deficit at the moment?
Well, during 2021, it roughly averaged about 3 billion Namibian dollars per month. And that deficit has come down slightly.
So per month?
Per month.
Per month.
So it has come down slightly in recent months, owing to rising exports, as you've mentioned earlier. And so I think at the moment we're averaging about 2.4, 2.5 billion trade deficit per month year to date.
So we hear often economists talking about the current account and the trade deficit. And let's break this down into layman's terms. Namibia buys stuff. We import stuff that our consumers or companies want.
Yeah.
And we sell stuff that the rest of the world wants, much like a shop, right?
Yeah.
And we're currently losing $3 billion a month in leakage. So roughly $35 to $40 billion a year
yeah.
leaves our account. that right?
Yes.
How do we fix that? That sounds terrible. I mean, that's $40 billion is a lot of money. You know, we didn't have money to pay anyone during COVID. Who pays for that? And how do we fix it?
Yeah. So, look, exports earn foreign currency when it's sold to foreign countries. But then imports also have to be paid in foreign currency if it's especially imported from overseas countries. Obviously from South Africa, where we who is our biggest importer, where we import most from, we pay in rand. But ideally you'd want your exports to exceed imports so that you earn more foreign currency than what you have to pay for your imports. And then in that way you run a surplus on your financial account that's also part of the current account. So the current account is made up of your financial account as well as the trade balance. So on the trade, it's simply, you know, do we sell more than what we buy from other countries? And in the financial account, it just says, you know, how much money do we earn more money from foreigners or from foreign countries and than what we pay to foreign countries? So that combined then brings about the current account balance. And running consistently running a trade deficit is negative for government because that then also runs down on your foreign currency reserves. And since we have our currency pegged to the rand in South Africa, we need some healthy levels of foreign currency reserves to also maintain that peg. So that if we need to intervene in the forex market to manipulate our currency so that it's one-to-one with the rand, we need that buffer. We need that healthy levels of foreign currency reserves.
Okay, so a man in the street, if you spend more than you make, you run out. Then you've got to go borrow money. So these are the borrowings we talk about, the debt that the country runs. So really the fix is we've got to be selling more than we're buying. So that's exports, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about exports. Give us an idea over the last 10, 15, 20 years. How have exports been doing, and is there hope that one day we will run a surplus?
Yeah. So I think there are maybe two interesting trends, long-term trends that I've seen with our trade statistics. The first one is that from the year 2000, so let's say the last 21 years, because the data only runs till 2021. For the last 21 years, what's interesting to note is that the value of exports is price times quantity. So you have those two components. And what we see is that the quantity of exports, the actual number of goods that we export has been declining over the last 21 years. But the value of exports has been increasing. So the difference between those two must then be a price effect. In other words, inflation. Now, I adjusted the value of...
Or our currency devaluing, which we've also seen.
Yeah.
And we get higher prices simply because our dollar is worthless.
Exactly. And I'll get to that. So I adjusted the value of our exports for local inflation. And that removed about 40% of the gap. So that tells me 60% of the gap is most likely coming from the currency effect, which you also indicated now. The rand used to be at about 8.78 against the US dollar in 2006, 2007. And today we're at over 16. So it's depreciated by over 50% since then. So the currency depreciation has significantly boosted our export earnings. Because obviously if I'm selling my copper or diamonds in US dollar and the rand is just getting ever weaker, then of course I'm earning a lot more for a certain amount of exports. So quantity has been coming down, but mainly it's the weaker exchange rate and rising prices that have boosted our export earnings. That's not really a good position to be in because that means year after year, we physically produce less, but yet we earn more just because of prices. So, you know, the mining companies might be earning good profits on that because of prices going up and the rand going weaker. But in terms of our society, that's negative because if I'm producing less, I need less people. And I don't necessarily have to expand my business, so I don't need to invest. So for our society, that's a big negative. But obviously for individual companies, it could be positive.
So is it fair to say that this is a real problem that to some extent has been hidden by the fact that our currency is getting weaker, which in itself is a problem. And so the two problems together hide the fact that actually our exports are in trouble.
Yeah. No, definitely. We cannot just continue riding the wave of a weaker rand. That in itself is inflationary. When we export copper, for example, to China, and then we import microwaves, cell phones, TVs that have used that copper in the production of those goods. And if our rand, if the exchange rate goes weaker, we pay more for those imported merchandise goods in the end of the day. So your exporting company might earn more profits, but then your end consumer, your household that buys the finished imported merchandise good, they end up actually also paying more because of the weaker rand. So in that way, it filters through that it is a negative for our economy.
Okay. So let's perhaps just see if we can dig into this a little bit. What are perhaps the two or three key underlying causes? Because if our currency had devalued and we had kept the volume of exports at levels from 2000, be right in assuming that actually we'd be in a great position because we'd have taken advantage of these rising, of these weaker currencies, but effectively rising prices, and we could have been running surpluses.
Yeah.
So why haven't we? Over the last 22 years, why haven't we seen exports increase?
Yeah. Look, the interesting thing is, if you look at the composition of our exports, it's mainly predominantly focused on commodities, raw materials, and fish. Now, with fish, we know there has been quite a bit of investment in land processing facilities or factories to add a bit of value to the fish before it's exported. But with our commodities from the mining companies, we do polish a bit of diamonds. There is a bit of processing for copper and zinc and so forth. But mainly, our economy has not advanced to a position where we actually take the metals or raw materials that we mine in our own country and we actually use it in a factory to produce something or to produce stuff.
Why?
So the manufacturing sector is plagued by a lot of regulations that create inefficiencies, a lot of policies that don't create a pro-business environment for our local manufacturers. So from that perspective, I think government can do a lot to improve the manufacturing production in this country. There's not much incentive. For example, the retail charter has been signed into legislation, but it's not actively enforced. So our local manufacturers still struggle to get their products onto the shelves of retailers that are still dominated by South African franchises. I mean, just an interesting story there. Local manufacturers have to send their products to Cape Town for clicks to get it into their warehouses, and then from there they put it back onto trucks that come all the way from Cape Town back to Windhoek. And then from here it gets distributed to various outlets throughout the country. That is a big inefficiency because now you have a duplication of transport costs, for example. Instead of the Namibian manufacturer just selling his cream or body lotion or soap or whatever it is directly to some sort of clicks distribution center here in Windhoek, it has to go to Cape Town and then from Cape Town back here.
It's a fine line, though, in creating a protectionist market, which in itself creates inefficiencies.
Yeah.
Mostly due to lack of competition. If you've got first grab at everything, you don't have to be particularly good at it. And obviously range and variety, which consumers increasingly want.
Yeah.
So that's a fine balance that you're perhaps, if I'm hearing you correctly, are saying government hasn't quite gotten that balance right yet.
Yeah, and I think government can do a lot more to sort of protect, especially your SME manufacturers. So, I mean, the Namibia Manufacturing Association between 2020 and now have lost a significant number of members, but it was mainly focused in the SME manufacturers. And the reason why is because government policies don't necessarily assist them in getting their products onto the shelves of retailers throughout the country. The other interesting thing was that after the pandemic outbreak, government actually introduced a levy on or a tax on sanitizing products, where some SME manufacturers locally decided to take advantage of the pandemic and produce their own sanitizing products. But then obviously at the same time, government introduced a tax on that. So, and then that also made them uncompetitive, because then automatically they also become, their sanitizers become more expensive than the sanitizers we import from South Africa and elsewhere.
Right? They've got to make for a small market.
Exactly.
So they don't get that advantage efficiency of scale.
Exactly. So there's a misalignment in incentives, because that was not the time for government to introduce such a levy or a tax. And that actually led to the actual closure of some SME manufacturers, because producing sanitizers was sort of a last resort for some of them to generate an income.
Okay, so let me interrupt for a second, if I may. Yeah. In manufacturing, right? Manufacturing is a challenge worldwide. America's lost enormous amounts of its manufacturing to China.
Mm.
The East has taken manufacturing away as a base industry for many advanced economies. We, with the greatest respect to our economy, are not an advanced economy.
Yeah.
And we don't have scale. We also don't have big markets. So manufacturing, potentially, SME, potentially, it creates ripple effects, but it doesn't solve the export problem. It's unlikely we're going to be able to produce to scale for big foreign markets at a price advantage. What else is there? We've got tourism, which is a direct injection.
Yeah,
but it has to be dealt with in a sustainable manner, and is obviously very disruptible by world events, as we've seen.
Yeah,
we've got mining commodities. We haven't mentioned agriculture. We've built the huge Nicotol Dam. There's a 5,000 hectares scheme that at some point will happen, apparently. But we've also had massive droughts, and we've got global warming, which is creating chaos really in the agricultural sector.
Yeah.
So, what agriculture for a second? We've seen an increase in meat exports.
Yes.
We're starting to see charcoal really grow as a potential export market.
Yeah.
Is this our way out?
I think so. Agriculture is one of the sectors that support our 2.5% GDP growth forecast for 2022. I think we've seen improved rainfall even compared to last year. So, you know, that's also boosted or assisted rather in the livestock production, and that's assisted increasing our exports drastically in the first quarter of this year alone. So I think that also continues to incentivize farmers to continue restocking or increasing their herd. So I think that should be positive for the livestock sector as well. For crop farming, we know that some areas in the north have received rains. Some have received excessive rains that have caused floods. So that could be a small negative. And then other areas have just received late rains, especially the maize triangle between Otavi, Grootfontein and Chume. You know, they've received late rains. So that will be negative for their maize production or maize harvest. But overall, if we look at the decisions made by the Namibian Agronomic Board, I think we can expect positive growth coming out of the crop sector. And the reason for that is that they've actually increased the number of food products that are not allowed to be imported. So in April, they had about 4 products that you were not allowed to import, because local production would meet demand, according to their estimates. And then for May, they've actually increased it to about 14 products. So the fact that they increase the number of food products you're not allowed to import means that it tells us that there's clearly an increase in local production that would likely meet demand.
But that's dropping imports.
Demand.
That's not increasing exports.
Yes.
Yeah, we're out of time. It's a fascinating topic. As there always is, there's 1,000 different aspects to these things. Thank you very much for coming in and talking a little bit about the deficit. But the reality is we need to find $3 billion a month from somewhere.
Yeah.
And we need government to really lay the foundations for business to solve that problem. Would that be fair?
Yes, no, definitely. That is the way forward. We need to, and like I said, mining production is expected to increase this year, but we can't just rely on mining continuously. At some point, we need to diversify the economy. We need to improve agricultural output by, you know, not doing communal farming anymore, and rather doing large-scale commercial farming, especially in the north. We need to look at reducing our water and electricity costs, and there are options for that. To also then, you know, help our manufacturing sector try and be a bit more cost effective, to at least produce some products that we consume on a daily basis. For example, toothpaste or, you know, whatever. If we can produce a bit more of that, and just import less, then, you know, that could also improve our trade deficit and the outflows.
Tia, we're out of time. Thank you so much. I'll do my bit this weekend, drinking local beer. That's Tia Klein, economist from Simona Storm, talking a little bit about the trade figures. The monthly reports are released every month from Simona Storm on these things. If you're interested in them, they're available on the website. And if you can't find it on the website, you can get hold of Simona Storm. Theo is standing by to take your calls, ladies. And he's always open to dates, proposals as well. Just kidding. He's an economist. Thanks so much for coming in, Theo.
Thank you for having me.
That's this evening's Market Watch here on The Business Report.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
We move on to a story that came out today. The Bank of Namibia and the Ministry of Finance today officially launched Namibia's Sovereign Wealth Fund. Known as the Welvichia Fund, it will have a balanced mandate where 70% of the assets bought are risky assets, such as equities, while the rest is made up of fixed income assets, things like real estate and other private equity. An exciting day, potentially, for Namibia. With more on the fund, here is independent economic researcher Rodney Hwabeb.
It's a positive development. It will help us to align more the savings culture for our economy, and also that we can, you know, go towards a path of raising more money for our investments instead of relying more on other outside countries. And it will also be good to retain the debt position of the country, like instead of relying on companies, private institutions, I think we can push the debt towards more Namibian. The other thing is it also give us strength to buy into our mineral resources and mining and other activities that are good for long-term sustainable development. You realize how other countries develop is that they create avenues or facilities to absorb economic activities that are closing gap. Say, for example, we have got mines that are struggling, the output is struggling, and now we know that these mines are there for long-term sustainability, jobs in these neighborhoods or, you know, the proximity towns that they are. But then instead of reaching out to investors constantly, we can say, look, these mines, they cannot be absolutely closed, but it would benefit the country to have them open because of jobs and because of even little output that you get from them. So that is where the Sovereign Wealth Fund can come up.
Moving on now to mining, and the African Mining Indaba, which is the world's biggest mining investment event, is currently underway in Cape Town, South Africa. Bufelu Lushatile, the Deputy Director of Geophysics in the Ministry of Mines and Energy, is attending the Indaba.
The main focus of this year's mining Indaba has been on the evolution of the African mining, basically on the green energy transition, as well as the type of minerals that are needed to do that transition. And there's been a lot of focus as well on the environment, social and governance principle aspect of new projects that are needed in the mining industry. So what we can take away from this is that the demand for critical minerals that are needed for electric vehicle is going to be about 60% more in the next 30 to 40 years. So all the investors, all the big consumer countries that are considered not a well-rich mineral resources countries are at the conference trying to look for opportunities of where to invest their money so that they can secure supply of these minerals in the coming future so that they can fit into their supply chain, into their manufacturing industry. So there's been quite a lot of appetite. All we need to take away from that is that we need to enhance our geological mapping, enhance our geological databases so that would be a preferred country for foreign investment. And then secondly, the easy of mineral right application, I think it's coming out a lot where we need our turnaround in terms of mineral application response is quite high so that it's more competitive compared to others, and access of geological information so that investors don't start from scratch when they come to your country, but they start with baseline data that's already existing, because collecting this geological data for them to make an informed decision on where to invest is quite expensive. So the baseline data provides them with existing information already, which they could base their decision on already, rather than trying to collect this data from scratch, as they are time consuming and again, they are quite expensive.
You're listening to The Business Report here on Nova 1035. And we turn our attention now to, we spoke a little earlier in the program about export products and trying to close the deficit on the current account. And obviously one of those products that is a direct export, even though it happens here, is tourism, because money comes directly into the country for goods and services purchased here. So it's an important part, and has for a long time been an important part of the Namibian economy. Now, the Institute for Public Policy Research has released a report providing a broader overview of the COVID-19 pandemic's impact on Namibian tourism and the response of the industry in mitigating its most harmful effects. The author of the report and a research associate at the IPPR, Dietrich Remmert, is our guest this evening. Dietrich, welcome to the show. Penning a report like this is often a labor of love. It's often a challenge to get it read by the right people, and in many cases by lots of people. So we want to dig into the report a little bit. To tell us a little bit about the report, why such a report?
Gary, thank you very much for the opportunity. I will try to keep it short. So, you know, as Namibia, we know that tourism is actually quite an important sector of the economy. So I thought, as well as the donors, decided that, you know, this was an important area to look at further. You know, we've just been through the COVID pandemic. It's not quite yet done. There's been a lot of discussion about the industry in general. You know, where are we going? What's going on? Some controversies, etc. So I thought it would just be important to do a proper paper on this and actually look at the kind of different nuances, also what's happening international. I think it's very important to always reflect that and what Namibia can learn from that, as well as what Namibian operators are actually doing right.
Okay. Sometimes data is the issue with these reports. And was it relatively easy to find the information you were looking for?
Not really. So you have a good point. Data, we often at the Institute struggle with accessing good data. Namibia does have, you know, a fairly comprehensive set, economic data, some labor data, things like that. But they're often dated and they're not disaggregated. So if you want to look, for example, tourism specifically, we still don't quite do that in our, you know, national household service, etc. Okay. We look at the hospitality and hospitality industry, transport, etc. And that sort of gets aggregated into you know, estimates around tourism. So it remains a big challenge for us. But we always also consult, you know, industry experts. We try to get sort of the kind of, if you will, the different perspective on that to add to the data. I think that's very important to sort of just don't have a dry things around, just around figures.
Okay. So tourism obviously took an enormous impact. I don't think anyone in Namibia didn't immediately see the impact of that, people they knew or people they had connections to. It drives a large part of both the formal and the informal sector. And it was immediate. It came to an absolute dead stop, as it did all around the world. But we're very reliant on this particular sector for foreign currency. At the onset, it was going to be 3 weeks, and then it was going to be 3 months. We'll be lucky if it's 3 years now. But there was always the anticipated bounce back. Something would happen afterwards, whatever afterwards meant and whatever something would happen would mean. So this report is titled The Post-COVID Bounce Back. So perhaps let's dig into a little bit. What are the findings of the report? How has the bounce back gone?
So in a nutshell, we are definitely not out of the woods yet. Also international, of course, there are a lot of sort of, if you will, green shoots. So you see more travelers from Europe. You see the U.S., you know, gearing up, and there being lots of more people. Asia is sort of struggling. So there is still a lot of uncertainty. I think this is one of the important things to highlight in the report. It is difficult to forecast. You know, I'm not an economist. I'm more political scientist by training. But everything that we see international is, say, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of hope and there's some positive development, but there's also things which we're just not yet clear about and it's difficult to sort of forecast. And maybe I can just quickly drill into that. So what I tried to do in the report, I sort of looked at sort of a more medium, longer term, if you will, look at the sort of long-term forecasting. Like I said, it's never clear cut, but what is sort of internationally, what are the big organizations, the big kind of, there's the World Travel and Tourism Council, a tourism body, which is producing some really good, concise data and reports. You know, what can the tourism industry expect for the near and further future. So these are the kind of things I really wanted to bring out the report and see, you know, is Namibia doing the same thing, or are there certain differences and where we are maybe, you know, need to catch up or adjust our thinking from a business perspective specifically.
Okay, so we're not doing a Game of Thrones review here. We don't have to worry about spoiler alerts. How are we doing? Give us some of the findings.
Well, in terms of international trends, we're not doing too bad. So obviously there's a lot of emphasis these days on health and hygiene, you know, to have, you know, a clean, proper room and be certain that everything is cleaned on a regular basis, let's say at the lodge, etc. That's standard practice. You know, it's not, you cannot get away, especially in sort of a higher segment, just, you know, offering, you know, substandard hygiene. You can't. It's international things now. And then, of course, there are things like a big trend that has come about is because people want to sort of move into the open spaces. They want to have the open spaces, which of course is great for Namibia. Because,
place to our strength.
Exactly. I mean, we're all about nature products in the industry. That's really our big selling point, one of the big selling points. So this is very positive for Namibia, these kind of international trends. The thing that is maybe not so good, or something that we don't advertise that much is there's a more emphasis on sustainability and, you know, meaningful travel is what it's called, or responsible travel is another word that's being thrown around, which basically sort of emphasizes the whole, you know, people during the pandemic have been much more conscious about the kind of impact on the environment and also the kind of mental health, et cetera, et cetera. So all these kind of things sort of coalesce together. And there is quite a number of strong indications internationally that this is going to become more and more important. So people are not just going to look at the, you know, price and where they want to go, but they're also going to look at what is going to be the impact. You know, what is my carbon footprint if I travel to XYZ? How does the local operator treat local communities, for example, in the area I want to travel to? And this is something I think Namibia has always been, the industry has always been quite conscious about sustainability because, you know, you have to protect nature. It's sort of the bread and butter. But, and this was one of the astounding things for me, it doesn't seem to be a big discussion point in the industry or even government. Like, nobody's talking about this. And which is, for me, it's a bit of a concern if we treat that too lightly and say, ah, Namibia is doing everything correct. But are we really? And are we really having these kind of discussions, even if it's just from a point of marketing ourselves better as a country and saying, hey, we've done renewable energy at lodges, solar, you know, water, whatever, for years and years and years. You know, come to Namibia, you know, we have, apart from the flight, a lot of the stuff will be low carbon. And this is something I think the industry itself and government and other stakeholders have to be more conscious about and look at more closely.
Okay, so maybe missed opportunity there, but something that we can fairly quickly get onto. Mm. Anecdotally, the lodges are full. The car rental companies don't have enough cars. We're not going to have enough cars because Durban washed away. So there's some challenges as well to recovery. How do we accelerate recovery?
You're absolutely right. So this report, I added some extra data in from April, but it's titled March. So it's always a bit tricky, you know. You try to bring it out as soon as possible and then things sort of change, but we brought it on anyway. I think there's still a lot of relevant information in the report. How do we accelerate now? I think we really have to start looking what is happening internationally and thinking around, is that, you know, what is appropriate to the industry and where can we, like I said, with the sustainability aspect, this is something that really has to be looked at in more depth. We also talked a bit about vaccination rates, so what's happening. And that, of course, we're not doing very well. And I don't think we're going to, you know, upscale this very suddenly. But I think the good thing is that a lot of tourism operators have tried to get, you know, a large proportion of their staff vaccinated and really encouraging them. So that's very positive. And I think, again, this doesn't come out much enough. Internationally, there is talk about, you know, there's a pent up, you know, people want to travel. And some people even talk about rage travel, which is a bit crazy. But yeah, And that is positive, but we might, you know, think a bit around our marketing, how best we can capture that better. So that's essentially it.
Okay. Just lastly, when we talk about economic recovery or sectors, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the role of government in all of these things. In many cases, government carries the blame from many people we speak to as to either policies are wrong or they're not followed through or there's some weaknesses and omissions. Government has been pretty much front and center in the tourism space. It would look like they've been fairly willing to make concessions to this particular sector. Perhaps just briefly comment is what did government's role, what was government's role through this period now that comes out of the report?
Well, obviously balancing the kind of, you know, restrictions against economic impact, which has been very tricky. And in government's defense, I think they've done, in 2020, they have done okay, you know, giving the limited information, the limited resources, the economic pressures, etc. I think 2021 was quite a failure, especially when we consider, you know, the huge third wave in, around June, July. Specifically around tourism, I think the big concern, again, and just something to pick out and highlight, is the kind of tension that we see between, you know, the kind of government announcing we want to be sustainable, we want to be green, we're doing this, very positive, you know, speaking, and then at the same instance having these concerns about the extractive industry. You know, there's a lot of debate within the industry about, you know, oil and gas explorations and other mineral explorations, and those getting basically, you know, fast-tracked by the government. So you have a feeling that it's a lot of ambiguity around that. You know, what is government actually, what they are actually saying? And I think this is a huge concern for the industry, and that needs to be addressed, and probably best if all stakeholders get together and just have a honest discussion and support it with lots of solid data, you know, not get emotions into it.
Dietrich, just if anyone wants to read this report, where can they find it?
So you could find it on the IPPR's website, www.ippr.org.na, or you can just Google, you know, tourism, COVID bounce back, Namibia, you will definitely find it. Other unfortunate thing, there isn't that much good documentation, so I hope this sort of will contribute to, you know, the general knowledge out there, be it, you know, in business or, you know, as a private person, wherever. So
thanks very much for coming in this evening. That's Dietrich Remmert, the author of a briefing paper called Namibia's Tourism Industry, Post-COVID Bounce Back, Gradual Recovery or Transformation, backed by the IPPR and the Hunsiedel Foundation, and you can find that on the IPPR website. We hope the bounce back is sharper than it's been up to date. It's an important part of the country's recovery, and I'm sure we all can't wait to get back out there again. It's the Business Report here on Nova 103.5.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report, Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 103.5.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. The Namibian dairy industry has, since last year, been under a lot of pressure and facing decreasing production volumes and a high-cost regimen that has pushed producers out of the sector. But Minister of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, Kalesh Schletfein, says plans are in place to try to help. Sticking with agriculture, Agribank says its arrears are currently standing at $500 million, a situation that could threaten the sustainability of the bank. In other local news, Deputy Prime Minister Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwa says that Namibia's ties with the European Union remain rock solid, evidenced by the $22 billion Namibian worth of goods exported to the continent, but there is room for improvement. The Road Fund Administration says they are still considering tolling some of the country's roads as a sustainable source of revenue for ongoing road maintenance and improvement. The Development Bank of Namibia has signed an agreement to provide $193 million Namibian dollars to finance a new solar power generation plant near the Khan substation in the Namib Desert. And the Bank of Namibia and the Ministry of Finance officially launched Namibia's Sovereign Wealth Fund on the 12th of May 2022. Known as the Velvichia Fund, it will have a balanced mandate where 70% of the assets bought are risky assets such as equities, while the rest is made up of fixed income assets, real estate and private equity. And in some different local news, Labour expert Herbert Jauch says that May's numerous public holidays provides the opportunity for the country to rethink the way we work.
This is an opportunity now to shorten working days and working weeks in many sectors of the economy. And if one looks at it from the macroeconomic level, the economy as a whole, we actually have an opportunity to reduce working time and still have the same amount of output productivity. The old concept of an 8-hour working day or 9 hours like it is in our Labour Act, where it talks of a 45-hour working week, is actually still a very old concept, because if people are less worn out, the level of performance is also likely to increase.
Looking further afield, Roger Baxter, the CEO of the Minerals Council of South Africa, says that the country could unlock almost 100 billion rand of investment if it cleared red tape. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa on Saturday ordered banks to stop lending as part of a raft of measures he said were aimed at stabilizing the economy. But the AFP News Agency, in an article that can be read on the news blog page of the Future Media website, explains that the move has been criticized by the country's captains of commerce, who say it will backfire, create a parallel banking system, and usurp efforts to fix the moribund economy. And the group of seven leaders from the world's seven wealthiest nations have committed to phasing out dependency on Russian energy and called on Russia to end its blockade and all other activities that further impede Ukrainian food production and exports in line with its international commitments.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Wow, what a packed show, covering on topics ranging from invasions of our right to privacy, a new investment fund for Namibia, and hearing inspirational stories of a personal journey in education and the difference that one person can make. That's it for this evening's business report. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Gary Strubel, and thanks to my team, Angie Skoltz, David Bishop, who helps out, Raymond Ziefeld, our technical producer, and as always, to you for listening, for responding, for getting in touch with us, which you can do tbr@nova.com.na. And if you caught something and maybe missed some of it and like to hear more, you can go catch this episode and all our previous episodes on nova.com.na. Go to podcasts and you'll see the business report there. Feel free to let us know what you'd like to listen to, and go and catch us on Twitter as well. Our Twitter handle is TBR. So thanks for listening. Have a wonderful Thursday evening, and we'll be back next week, same time, but different stories.
That was The Business Report on Nova 1035. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Strubel and produced by Limey Ilago and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.